So a tribute to Granny, that's Maggie Ingram and the Ingramettes. I think that's from the Rough Guide to Gospel. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. This is the week of quite momentous changes here in Britain, a bit of tectonic plates shifting with Liz Truss being inaugurated as Prime Minister, and a couple of days later, Queen Elizabeth II passes away. So I'm joined on the line by Richie Allen from Manchester, from Salford. Richie, can you hear me?
You're coming through loud and clear, Tony.
Good to hear your voice, Richie. And I'd like to just, you know, set off this amazing week, because, you know, it seems incredible to me that somebody can make Liz Truss the Prime Minister and then just die, literally 2 days later. I've always worried about when Queen Elizabeth goes, because whatever you might think of her, she seemed to be someone who still remembered the difficulties of the Second World War. She certainly tried to keep out of the spotlight. She was a sort of charitable figure that was the patron of several charities, but she didn't really have much of a political push, certainly around things like climate and this kind of thing, architecture, talking to plants and things like that. She didn't have much of a public profile. Prince Charles, now King Charles III, is completely different, isn't he? So what do you make of this, first of all, the death of the Queen, and secondly, where we're going with Charlie?
I heard you earlier on, you and your colleague Martin, talking about the suddenness of it, and just by coincidence, while I was listening to you talk about it, I was watching Sky News at the same time, and a woman called Jane Secker was interviewing... I should have written this down, but I didn't have time. She was interviewing a bishop who resides in Balmoral, and someone who the Queen would have attended. The Queen would have attended his services, and in fact attended his service last Saturday. And he expressed bemusement, to put it mildly, that she had passed away yesterday, and said that when he saw her and spoke with her briefly on Saturday, she looked very well. Now, I know that doesn't mean anything, but it's worth noting, because you and Martin talked about it a little bit later on. You know from butting heads with me over the years that while I have enormous respect for you, and while this is only my opinion, and I can say it can be argued, and that's what I always say, it can be argued, that whatever the Queen was, in my opinion, she was the front woman or front person for an organisation that controls the City of London and the Crown Corporation, a malevolent organisation partnered with other organisations like some of the biggest banking cartels and finance houses in the world, to shape the world in their image. Now, whether you want to get into how much of that the Queen was involved in, or the Queen's father or his predecessor, I just don't know. But for me, the institution is poisonous, it's corrupt, it's filthy, it always has been, and I can't say how much of any of that, if I'm right, by the way, that the Queen would have been conscious
so,
of.
So but do I, you I, rather I, like, Richie, do you rather like the idea that Charles is now out there, because he's a bit more upfront, isn't he? You know, he's doing these suitcases full of cash and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would never be the... Do you think he's being more honest than she was?
I don't know if he's being more honest, but I think you and I touched on this last year after the death of the Duke of Edinburgh. We talked about the possibility that Charles was going to become the high priest of the climate change agenda. I hate to use these cliches because they sound so boring and redundant in my own earpiece here, but let's just call it that, the climate change agenda. It's one of the few things that I think you know this. I love speaking to people on my show because I don't really know very much, and I like to listen and challenge and ask questions. But if there's one thing that I've researched, and I'll take the Pepsi challenge with anybody, it's climate change. Man-made CO2 is not warming the planet. I say that with my hand on my heart because I used to be somebody who believed in it. I did believe in it because I came out of a Socialist Workers' Party background in the mid to late 1990s, Sinn Féin, the political wing of Sinn Féin, just in case any of your listeners are wondering. I've been an anti-violence campaigner my entire life. But I went along with, you know, I pigeonholed myself. Yeah, well, if they say it's happening, it must be happening. I think he's perfectly positioned now to become the high priest of it. I know that's a bit of a soundbite, a bit of a cliche there. But maybe there's more to her passing now than meets the eye. Did you tell me one time, I think you told me, I don't want to sound like I'm buttering you up, I like when we argue, to be honest, it's better when we argue, but didn't you tell me at one time that her father was effectively euthanized?
Wasn't he? I don't think so.
Or his predecessor. one of them was effectively euthanized to make the news, to make the the publishers, the printing press deadline. One of them that was very ill. It might have been George VI that was basically given.
No, that's not me, Richie. But I mean, you know.
But I've heard that.
He did die early, didn't he?
He did die early. He had lung cancer, but he wasn't on his last legs. So look, that's we're kind of segueing.
I'd just like to look at the media side of what happened yesterday. Because it was rather peculiar. I was making my breakfast about 9:30, and I just felt this very strange sensation. I won't, you know, go into it in any detail. I just thought something's wrong. What is wrong? And I actually spent about 2 minutes searching around the kitchen to try and find what was wrong, and I wasn't really sure what was going on. I wonder whether, you know, that was, I was picking something up there, because when the announcement came around about midday, I think that it was, that the Queen was severely ill, I wonder whether maybe she hadn't actually passed on even at that stage. And, of course, you've got to be quite careful how you tell the public, especially if she's died suddenly. They don't want to be saying, right, the Queen has just died suddenly, because people will start asking questions, Richie, won't they?
People will ask questions. You're absolutely right. And look, I want to acknowledge Martin in the background there, because I listen to this program regularly and I really enjoy it. And I have great respect for, you know, the opinions of others. And I always punctuate everything I say with, look, I just don't know. But I do believe I take a different line on global events to Martin. I really do believe that there is a lot more organized control over events than meets the eye. I'm also not stupid enough to think that every single politician and every minister or minister of state is in on whatever might be happening, the Great Reset agenda, the whole climate change thing. But I've looked at it so many ways over the years, Tony. I see how politicians, you know, I was looking into this today, knowing that you were going to ask me about some of this stuff, you know, how government ministers and even prime ministers are advised by special advisors, you know, SPADs as they're called, and civil servants, and how those people get their directives from think tanks, you know, right wing or left wing think tanks, and where they're getting their advice from is anybody's guess. But ultimately, nothing ever changes, you know, regardless of which party has held power in the last 35-40 years. But the agenda has advanced.
Yeah, the difference between, or the transition, if you want, between Liz and Boris to Charles and the other Liz Truss.
That's incredible.
Is a massive change, isn't it? I mean, with Liz being very close to the World Economic Forum and Charles basically being Klaus Schwab's ambassador to Britain.
Yeah, the man who has said on many an occasion in this year alone, in 2022, that it's intolerable for humanity to continue on the path it's on, that massive changes have to be made to the way we live. He said this on a number of occasions, massive changes. And we know what those changes are, of course. You know, a kind of a subsistence living, a very uncomfortable, austere way of living our lives in cold houses, you know, told what we can and what we cannot eat, and told when we can and when we cannot go on holiday. Tony, you know me, you've known me long enough. I've never in my life bigged myself up. But the only time I've ever had an epiphany was back during the first lockdown, back in 2020. And I called it on my show, and I do get a little bit of credit for it. I said, wow, wouldn't it be easy to take this model and apply it to the climate, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it, to be telling people where they can and can't go based on the climate? And what have we seen in the few weeks that I've been off air, because I've been off air since July? We've seen floods in Pakistan. My God, Tony, we saw a few warm days this summer. My God, we saw a few warm days.
Well, the warmest. On record, actually.
The warmest. Well, we don't know that, to be honest, because we know that in millennia gone by, we know they were able to grow grapes in Yorkshire. We know that for a fact. I urge people to check out Ian Plimer and Green Murder. I know you had Robert on previously. He's a big...
I mean, I don't think you need to be a genius to work out the climate has changed to a certain extent. I know you don't agree with that, but let me put this little point in there, because I think the main problem, and there is some sort of change going on in the climate due to pollution. I think that pollution is coming from China, and I don't think anybody in this part of the world is going to have a war on China to close down those coal-fired power stations. If you want to go and get a job in one of the big Chinese cities, you'll find you have to go and wear, it's not just a face mask. Some of them wear oxygen masks.
Listen, you make a great point. And again, something we've bashed around over the years is the conflation of two problems, you know, or two alleged problems, one of which is real, environmental destruction. Listen, I still have a lot of friends, you know, from back home, school, college, who would describe themselves as Greens. And I agree with them. I say, yeah, of course, we're filthy. By we, I don't mean me, you, or Martin, or your listeners, but they're filthy. Corporations are filthy. Governments are filthy. Polluting every ocean on the planet, every river, of course. But I still don't buy into that what China is doing and what's happening in India is adversely changing the weather. Now, it's not because I don't want to. It's not because I've got my mind made up on it. I'm prepared to have my mind changed, Tony. But depending on who you believe, our atmosphere, you know what our atmosphere is made up of, right? Nitrogen, you know, I don't have to tell you the individual gases. People can Google them. But it's 0.0366% carbon or 0.04%, depending on which one you believe. And none of the climate models can definitively say how much of the 0.36 or 0.04% actually derives or comes from human activity. They just don't know. I would argue a lot of it comes from, you know, subsea volcanic activity. They don't mention the sun in their models. Look, I'm not an idiot, right? I know that we've made large swathes of the planet uninhabitable, not forever, but for a long time, because of what we're doing.
Richie, I think one of the most important things to understand about all of this is that they're trying to, put these various kind of zero carbon changes into law. They've already done this. We in Bristol are apparently going to have to pay £10 to turn around in our drive at the end of the week, at the end of this year. When I was growing up in the 1960s, getting a bus to school, we'd pay about 4 pence or something for a ticket to go to school. Before, I suppose when I was primary school age, you look down my street, there are about 4 or 5 cars in the entire street. We had a at cost public transport system. You could just hop on a bus, get a train up to London into another city. Everybody used public transport. It hardly used any energy. And so what's happened is that the price of energy has been brought right down. Now everyone's hooked on it. They're saying, right, we've got them now.
We've got them now. You're absolutely right. And going back to your early discussion about Ukraine, I found that fascinating, and I agree with a lot of that. But I've asked you this over the last 6 to 8 months. I wonder about Russia, if we believe everything that we've read and learned in school and everything that we've worked on in our various radio stations, you work for the BBC, I've worked in commercial radio mostly and briefly in national radio. If we believe everything we've been told, there was a promise made to Russia at the end of the Cold War that NATO wouldn't advance any further. We know that NATO did. We know that the US has put bases all across Europe. And so on the face of it, Russia has a legitimate grievance with NATO and with the West, 100%. Russia invades Ukraine. 2 things I don't understand about that. Let me ask you these questions. I know it's your show, and then I can't wait. I'm all ears here.
I love it.
To say.
Go on.
But number one is, and please imagine the cheek of me to tell you how not to answer me. I don't buy this thing that Putin got it wrong or he's trying to be nice. Russia could have blitzkrieged Ukraine, taken Kiev, and then installed its own puppet government as the United States did in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's my opinion. Why didn't he do it? Why is it going on? And the most important question is...
Do you want me to answer that now?
Well, can I just ask this
brief second
question?
He wants to win over the hearts and minds of Ukrainians. He's not going to do it like that, is he?
I don't buy it. I'll tell you why in a moment. And my second question was, not a single politician, not a single journalist, and this doesn't surprise you, me, or your colleague Martin, or Dave there in the engineering, nobody is asking the question, why is the UK government and the US government spending billions to give arms to Zelensky for a conflict he can't possibly win, which is bankrupting the United Kingdom and plunging us into decades of poverty? Why is nobody saying the game is up? You've got to accept that it's got to be. So I think Martin touched on this earlier on. There must be a resolution. Why is Liz Truss or Boris Johnson not saying to Zelensky, listen, pal, game is up. You've got to negotiate with this bloke. We can't put up with this anymore. He's got to have Luhansk, whatever, Donetsk. He's got to have some territory there. He's got to feel secure. Now do it. Nobody's asking that question. Certainly not in the legacy media anyway.
Can I answer?
Get in there, Martin.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree with what Tony said earlier. The special military operation by the Russians is it's not like what the Americans did in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's more like the British intervention in Northern Ireland, you know, because this is a neighbouring country with a Russian-speaking minority that's being oppressed, and it's as if almost if like the Irish army had come in 1969 instead of the British army. So
right.
that's one of the things that's going on there.
That's an interesting point.
The politics of it are, you know, you know, it's not just a military problem, is it? You know, you're trying to resolve a political issue through military means. And, of course, they're trying to do what they're doing proportionately.
Martin, may I ask you a question, please? Sorry to interrupt you on your show. May I ask you a question? What about the possibility, Martin? Are you prepared to consider it? I mean, I don't come to these questions easily, that everything is manipulated, like that even the Russian position itself is manipulated. If we accept that there's a great reset agenda, an agenda to rapidly and irrevocably change human experience on planet Earth, well, we would all agree that this situation in Ukraine at the moment is furthering that agenda. So why not consider anyway, I'm not saying I'm right, by the way, why not consider that even guys like Putin are being pushed around into taking positions that maybe they don't want to?
Well, I think even the mainstream sensible people recognise that, you know, the Russians, Russia, I went to Russia in the 90s. I was working for the New Economics Foundation and I talked to people at the time in the 90s. And the people I spoke to just wanted to be a normal Western country. They really just, you know, so there's actually quite a strong tendency within Russian society to say, well, we're just ordinary people like you. We just want to be part of the West. We just want to, you know, we want to join the International Monetary Fund. It was, you know, they were really in that kind of mindset. What's happened subsequently, of course, is they've sucked it and seen what a load of rubbish free market neoliberal capitalism is. And, you know, the 90s in Russia were horrendous. It made Thatcherism in this country look like a Sunday afternoon tea party. And therefore, they've got no delusions about this free market nonsense. And that's why they've gradually moved away from that pro-Western position. But you still, and of course, you know, the Communist Party in China wanted to be part of, you know, the elites in both of these countries basically wanted to just join the party. And they've not been allowed to, which is why we've ended up with this kind of conflict, which again could be manipulated. I mean, the whole sanctions on Russia thing was geared to try and get the oligarchy, who they think runs Russia, to get rid of Putin. But Putin's support isn't really in the oligarchy. It's because he wins elections by improving the living standards of the ordinary people.
I take your point, by the way, Martin. I take your point about, you know, travelling in the 90s and speaking with Russian people. I know a couple of old socialist friends of mine were there as well. And I totally believe that's genuine. It's always genuine when you talk to the people.
Yes, well, when I went there, I was in Leningrad when they voted on the set that weekend to get rid of the Soviet Union, to change the name of the city back to St. Petersburg, and to elect Yeltsin as the president of Russia.
And I was drunk.
People weren't really aware of that at the time.
No.
And in actual fact, lots of Russian guys were and still are drunks. It's not that uncommon. And it's true. No. Nor in Ireland nor England, as I'm sure you're aware. And I felt like saying to them, well, what about Gorbachev? And they went, no, Gorbachev, load of rubbish. He's just a communist. We've got to get rid of him. And of course, when I was going around in Eastern Europe in that era, I was very careful to recognize that I didn't have the experiences of the people I was talking to. And I was there to listen to them tell me what they thought. But I remember thinking at the time is, you're probably going to regret this, but I'm not going to say anything.
No,
and now if you went to Russia and you mentioned Yeltsin, you'd just get a load of expletives.
That's right. And I wonder,
because at the time, they saw him as a saviour.
They saw him as a saviour. I wonder, is there a movement, is there a body of thought in Russia that begins to question, you know, are we mere pawns being pushed around by our leaders?
There's a strong awareness.
Regardless.
There's a strong awareness in Russia. Like, for example, you know that they've passed in the British Parliament this rule, these laws, the Tory government passed a law saying that the military, intelligence and police have all got the right to be above the law. So if they
that's
break
right.
the law...
Oh, and the Environment Agency, yeah, by the way. Yeah. All, yeah, sorts of right, these, all, right. the,
now,
all sorts of these government
institutions. What would happen in the Russian Duma if the government brought forward such a bill was they'd be laughed out of there. Because of the history of Russia, people are very well aware of the possibility of government manipulation and string pulling and so on.
There's
and so
a counterpoint
forth.
To that, Martin, I think. Sorry, Tony. There is a counterpoint to that, I think, and that is that Russia was no less giddy in terms of the Russian president and his cohorts in the Kremlin. They were no less giddy or jolly about imposing incredibly draconian restrictions on people during the COVID outbreak or the vaccines. You see, and these are things that I just can't ignore. I want to, as an old lefty, as an old Bolivarian socialist, I want to back the ideology or I want to believe in the reasoning of the Russian government in going into Ukraine, but I just don't buy it. You know, there was nothing in COVID in Russia that gave me any sense whatsoever that Vladimir Putin was some obstacle to this unfolding agenda. Back to you guys.
Well, look, first of all, Putin's approval rating is so much higher than any of our leaders. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Daily Express.
Doesn't answer my question,
Daily Express poll was saying that Truss had an approval rating of 18%. And Boris already was at around about 50%, and Sunak was 20%. So she's actually, what we're doing is we're selecting people that nobody really seems to want, and there's a system over here. The other thing, well, the reason I'm saying that is because I think Michael Hudson's 100% right, looking at the difference between Russia and what is really going on in that war is a battle between two different ideologies. One is the Russian and many other countries around the world see as the important role of government in keeping hold of infrastructure, having a mixed economy. When people vote, it actually does mean something because the government does run things. And over here now, we're seeing this ridiculous situation with Liz Truss, where she's now just basically handed the policy over to the private energy companies, to Shell and Exxon. They are writing the policy. And that, I think, is really what's going on in Ukraine. And that is exactly what the Russians are not going to put up with. They're saying that in our country, that's not going to happen. And the closer it gets to us, the more we're going to have to do something about it. And so that's why, you know, I think the approval rating things is important. You know, if there was any leader in this country over the last 20, 30 years that came anywhere close to where Putin is now, that the people actually wanted to run the country, it's just not going to happen right now, because we have a system which puts people in charge in this part of the world who don't act for the public. They act for private interests in the City of London.
Do you think there's this notion that you allow policy to be directed by private corporations, whether it's around energy, whether it's around climate, is that not a pretext or a prelude to a future of citizen assemblies?
Well, no.
You don't think
look,
so?
The other thing about Ukraine is, look, I mean, I interviewed Scott Ritter a few weeks ago about this, and he's done a lot of digging on casualties, because they're trying to keep this, all these figures under their hat. 25 times less civilian casualties than would be expected in any normal war are going on over there. And I think that's a major reason why the Russians are doing what they're doing, is they're making it clear to anybody on the ground over there that we are not here to kill civilians, and we're doing everything we can not to kill civilians. In fact, even when the Ukrainian army goes into a school or a hospital to start using it as a military base, the Russians are putting out announcements, public announcements, saying we have detected the Ukrainian army in a school, and we are not going to attack this school.
But
until
how do you know?
But
let me ask you this: how do you know thereafter that the Russian military hasn't attacked the target that it said it wouldn't do? You don't know that, and you're too good a journalist to just say that, because you're believing the Russians. You're choosing to believe.
Well,
Russia.
Actually, no. I was just quoting Scott Ritter.
Oh, Scott, excuse me, but you're taking Scott's word for it.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I'm sure there are others like Scott. I don't believe anything.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's right to be sceptical about everybody's propaganda. I think coming to the nub of what you were saying earlier, and if you're a regular listener to this show, you will know we've had massive debates and discussions about what COVID is, what the reaction to it is, and what side everybody's on all of that.
To your credit, yeah.
Well, I mean, my view on COVID, as Jeffrey Sachs, who was in fact involved in the destruction of Russia in the 90s, he's on the record now as saying that he thinks COVID is a biological warfare agent from a US laboratory. And he's on the board of The Lancet, which is the main medical journal. He's an economist, so I'm not quite sure why he's put in charge of this, but he was put in charge of investigating. And he was the one, Peter Daszak, who works for Eco Health Alliance, he was being given the job by The Lancet to find out where COVID came from. And he wasn't saying that in actual fact he was from Eco Health Alliance and they've been carrying out gain of function research funded by the Pentagon at the Wuhan lab.
I buy that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's very interesting that somebody like Jeffrey Sachs, who's a consummate insider, is coming out with this stuff. And in actual
fact, you have to know this stuff, Martin. You must, it's hugely important research and work to do on this radio show. Yeah, people have to know this.
Oh, what's happened, what Sachs himself has said, I can get an op-ed in any major newspaper in the United States, but as soon as I started talking about this, I was silenced.
Gone, just silence. You see,
well,
I'm
just a minute, Richie.
This,
hang on a sec.
Can I just say, Tony? Can I just say this? I'm obviously hugely fascinated by that. but the response to it.
All right, well, let's come to the priority.
For me, the priority has got to be what governments did in lockstep to respond to a respiratory infection that wasn't
There was surely already a plan, you know, to create as much of a crisis as possible in order to create the case for the COVAXes. But I just want to lay down the reason we got removed from FM. One of the main reasons was I mean this show has been being very critical of the vaccine prescriptions for a long time. I've given a lot of time to Andrew Wakefield and his work on the MMR vaccine and questioned the regulation of these sorts of things through the MHRA, the health regulator, you know, authorising these silicone implants for women and then finding that this was a complete disaster, their mesh of some sort. I mean, basically just doing whatever the industry wants. So the regulators are just not regulating, they're doing whatever the industry wants. And then when it came to the first show we had in 2020, we were reporting just simply something that had popped up on Zero Hedge, and that was the report from New Delhi saying that these virologists at New Delhi University had found that there were some very strange, you know, little inserts into what they called inserts into the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which, and to quote them, said that they're unlikely to occur naturally. Now, we were right on the ball, I think, right at the very start there, and it's taken the world, what, nearly 2.5 years to catch up with that. And so there's been a deliberate attempt to make sure that the public are not informed, that the media is oppressed and suppressed, and that actually what's going on right now is still a massive human experiment along the lines of Joseph Mengele in the Second World War, Richie.
Yeah, you mentioned 600. No, you didn't. You mentioned 60,000 earlier on. And I know there was a bit of tongue-in-cheek there. That 60,000 that you can directly attribute, you know, injuries that you can directly attribute to one of the jabs.
This is deaths due to non-treatment. Deaths due to non-treatment. That was what that came from Tess Laurie in Bath.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I interviewed that lady, yeah. As far as deaths go and death numbers, I don't do sensationalism. I looking at the yellow card data that's available, looking at the data from around other European countries, it's probably, well, I think it's highly likely, it's significantly higher than that. And as we speak now, they're texting people to come and have the autumn booster. And people like me are being texted. Strangely enough, I was texted during the week to come and have my first one. So we're getting there again, I think. I mean, is that how you guys see it, that
just take this opportunity to play a little clip for you, actually, with Dr. Stanley Laham. He's an immunologist based in Florida. He's retired now, worked with viruses all his life, discovered a new virus as part of his PhD, and he's been a real rock for me because he's taken us through all this. He's extremely careful about what he says and what he doesn't say. And I asked him what I thought was a really important question, and one of the things we've really got to take away from all of this. In fact, I'll put a link to the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where he takes us through what he's learnt from the whole COVID episode. But for me, the most important question, one of the key questions coming out of it all, is should we be treated for COVID and similar diseases and just simply catch them and get natural immunity, or do the vaccines actually make any sense whatsoever? And this is what he had to say.
There is no doubt that a combination of zinc, vitamin D, hydroxychloroquine, did give, protection and shortened the duration of the viral course of the pathogenicity of the virus. But these things were not only ridiculed, but they made it sound like, people were selling snake oil. And unfortunately, with their approved drug, if you remember, for 2 years, the only approved drug was remdesivir. When people spoke of ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine with vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc, and of course, an antibiotic to prevent, like azithromycin, to prevent secondary bacterial infection, and, if necessary, a steroid in order to prevent the cytokine storm that the virus caused, the over immune reaction that was causing coagulation in the alveoli of the lungs. And most people who went through that treatment, no matter how bad the strain of the virus was, whether it was the Delta strain, they went through it successfully and developed good natural antibody against it. Whereas we're seeing now, you know, people who are vaccinated twice, boosted twice, still catching, you know, new strains of the coronavirus. And no one has asked the question, well, you know, the coronavirus, like the poliovirus, is a single-strand positive RNA virus. One of the main differences between them is that the poliovirus is non-enveloped, whereas the coronavirus is an enveloped virus, which makes it a lot more susceptible to washing, to soap and water, than the poliovirus, which does not have this lipid envelope, lipoprotein envelope. The vaccines that were developed for poliovirus, whether it's the live Sabin vaccine or the dead Salk vaccine, created immunity that literally eradicated polio. And nobody asked, well, how come variants didn't spring up? Whereas with these mRNA vaccines, variants are springing up constantly. Well, the answer is very simple. These whole virus vaccines, the attenuated Sabin or the killed Salk vaccine, elicited multiple immune responses, multiple antibody formation towards many different structures of the virus. Whereas the mRNA that was injected, that can cause damage to many other organs, elicited one specific antibody to one specific protein of the coronavirus. So a very limited mutation could render that antibody that you're producing non-reactive. Whereas in order to have variants that were resistant to these other original vaccines of polio, you would have to have multiple mutations of multiple sites to render the original vaccine ineffective. Whereas with the mRNA vaccines, simple mutations. And as a matter of fact, the vaccine would select for these variants to pop up.
So that's Dr. Stanley Laham there speaking to me this week from Florida, just explaining this whole business of why it is that we keep getting all these variants. Oh dear, and we have to have another booster and another one and another one. Whereas back in the old days, Richie, a vaccine, you just took it once and that was it for life.
And lasted you a good long time, yeah. I mean, I know they did test children. We got the polio one when we were babies, effectively, and then when we were 14 or 15, they gave you a little test to see with some bruises, not some bruises, but some pimples appear on your arm. You're absolutely right. Just to follow on from that, way back in the mid part of 2020, when they were talking about vaccines, I interviewed the German scientist, a guy called, I can never pronounce the name, Sucharit or Sukharit Bhakti. And he was the first person I spoke to anyway who put out there the possibility that the mRNA jabs would, in many cases, not in all cases, but cause people's immune systems ultimately to attack them. He put it in far more flowery and scientific language than I have just done there, talking about spike proteins. But he said, you know, a lot of people who get these mRNA jabs will be exposed to coronaviruses again in the future, and it might be catastrophic for them.
Well, this is another thing that Stanley was saying right at the very start. He said, and he has a good knowledge of AIDS and other autoimmune diseases. He was saying, well, by putting an mRNA vaccine in there, what you're doing is that can hang around. And in fact, what it can do is it can be what he called reverse transcribed into your DNA. So you may get cells hanging around for years and years, maybe even in your organs, like the liver or kidneys or whatever, that are slowly chucking out these spike proteins through the rest of your life. Now, this is a recipe in old age for an autoimmune disease. And it's not impossible that these effects have had some sort of contribution to the death of the Queen, to the death of the Duke of Edinburgh, who've had these, and maybe many other people. And we've seen an enormous great, well, I don't think so necessarily. We've seen an enormous increase in the death rate. Now, that may be to do with the collapse of the National Health Service, but it needs to be properly looked at. We can't discount it, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Richie?
No, you're right. Didn't the General Medical Council or the British Medical Journal, didn't it publish something 2 weeks ago? It was picked up by the Telegraph, and only the Telegraph, which it said was pretty much near as damn it definitive proof that the cure was far, far worse than the disease, that lockdown itself has led to far more fatalities and will continue to lead to far more fatalities. So you're right to, very good to acknowledge that, you know, NHS people not getting appointments for a long time. I've had personal experience of this in my small circle of family and friends. As for the deaths, my God, Tony, you know, I'm obviously an Irishman. I don't just put on this outrageous accent. I love my Gaelic games back home. We had a young Tipperary hurler recently collapsed. Now, look, you can't be irresponsible. You can't just say that's down to the jab. Of course you cannot. But there is a plethora of these type of incidents. And if you look through the news archives, say, going back 5-10 years, you don't see so many stories about a young man or a young woman who collapsed on the field of play. You just don't.
Well, so you know what I've also noticed, we had just last week on our local news here, a story about how wonderful defibrillators, we need to have defibrillators everywhere. Because, of course, as you know, people who are exercising up on the downs here, you know, even if they're 25, they just might keel over because of a heart attack. So there's a sort of subtle approach here where they're normalising the idea of young people now just keeling over.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's an absolute given. I'm a 47-year-old baldy gammon. I'm 6'6" tall. It's all in proportion, ladies, just in case you're wondering. I weigh 13 stone 7 pounds. I'm unbelievably slim. I run 5 kilometres every single day. I don't take a day off. I've never had a vaccine. And I do have asthma, but I manage it by keeping fit. I don't get palpitations. This is going to be some ironic show for you next week, isn't it? When I drop dead next Wednesday on Liverpool Street in Salford. But look, yeah, I'm stunned by this. I mean, I'm a guy who probably shouldn't be pushing himself as hard as I do when I exercise. But to hear so many of these stories, there's another one developing, I believe. I came across something on Facebook earlier on. Somebody collapsed on a pitch in Lower Broughton, I think, Salford area. It would have been a young lad. Whether he had the jab or not, I don't know. But again, something very, very, very unheard of, that a young lad playing football would suddenly collapse unconscious on the pitch and have to be, you know, attended to.
Well, what you're doing is reminding me of Prince Charles's little declaration we need 3 planet Earths in order to accommodate all the population that there is here at the moment.
Yeah.
He's saying we have to reduce the world's population by at least 2/3. Well, I'm not sure about Martin. This is going back a long way. The elite saying actually we need to just get rid of loads of people. In fact, some have used it over the centuries, aristocracy, etc., to say, oh, well, it's time for another world war. Let's cull the population.
Well, I believe it was Jowett, was it? Who was a Catholic philosopher? And no, it was about Cardinal Newman, I think. He said, was it Cardinal? I can't remember who it was, but anyway, it was after the famine, and he said, I got a horror of economists when I realised these economists were saying that the famine hadn't killed quite enough people to resolve Ireland's economic problems. And this desire to get rid of the useless poor has been a strain running back in you know, establishment thinking going right back to the medieval.
And they sort of justify it to themselves by talking about eugenics, don't they? Saying, well, actually, these people are kind of, you know, a danger to society. They're carrying around rather dodgy genetic material, and it would be better if we just had a kind of purer human race.
Well, eugenics was discredited as an ideology after World War II, obviously, because the Nazis were very strongly in favour of it. But even before that, eugenics was a very respectable thing. George Bernard Shaw believed in eugenics. The Swedish Social Democrat Party compulsorily sterilised people that they thought were the wrong kind of people to have children.
And was regarded
as a progressive view.
Martin, now China, Britain and the United States are actually now experimenting with the whole idea of designer babies, where you can sit down and say, I want this and that. Now, that is, of course, eugenics, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. And wealthy people, if they can, are going to try and get the smartest, you know, they're going to buy the babies they want. They buy everything else that they want. They want the babies they want, and they want other people who have too many. The benefit rules in this country now are that if you've got more than two children in your family, the third child doesn't entitle you to any benefit payment. So that means big families, let's say, Catholic, Irish. It's true. It's the Tories brought that in.
They brought that in.
In other words, what they're saying is existing big families, you know, the Catholic Irish who drink too much and are scabs, those lot, they are not going to get, we're going to cut them off their benefits. Of course, what that means, I work in schools, is that kids from big families don't eat because they're not being given the benefits. You know, I think that's just wrong.
Once
a child is born, they should be treated as the community's responsibility.
And, you know, it's not that far, if you're looking at eugenics, to the point where, and I'm sure there are people who have this in their minds, saying, well, actually, I want my kids to be genetically modified so they don't die. And I'll pay for that. This is transhumanism.
Or good at sports or look good. Fascinating, this, isn't it? What Martin said there, I didn't know this about the third child. That's kind of blown me away.
It was shocking. And, of course, the Labour front bench had to wrestle with their consciences about whether they're going to oppose this or not. That's how far the rot's gone.
I know you're going to kick me off in a few minutes, by the way. Sorry to interrupt you, Martin. I know you're going to kick me off in a few minutes because our time is coming to an end.
We're a bit more flexible. We're not on FM radio here. I don't think we're going to pull the plug on you.
No, but you can, because I've got after seven, because I've got to... I'm looking after some Irish people all this week, T. I was telling you the other day. You said we were in town last night. So I'm otherwise engaged a bit later on.
Go on then, go for it, Richard.
Can I bring up some Irish news? Because I know you two are interested in it, because I do listen. I'm not lying when I say I listen. You can give me a pop quiz if you want on recent episodes. I'll tell you, I always listen. But I'm fascinated by Martin, I hear you talk about the, you know, lurch towards Orwellianism and this creeping dystopianism that we're seeing. Well, it's not creeping, it's on steroids now. Yeah. What about the teacher in Ireland, in Dublin, I think, Enoch Burke, who's in isolation in Mountjoy Jail, all because of two things. He refuses to use the preferred pronouns of a boy who wants to be referred to as a girl. And he also refuses not to come to work because he's not blotted his copybook. He's a teacher with an impeccable record. And they put him in jail for contempt of court. Now, this is a very right-wing type of story. I know you'll get your Julia Hartley Brewers and that mob really getting stuck into this. But to me, it's one of those shake your heads, kind of wipe your eyes and I can't believe this. I can't believe there's a bloke in isolation in Mountjoy Jail. Because of his Christian beliefs, by the way, because he won't call a boy a girl. Now, listen, my philosophy on this is live and let live. If you ask me politely, if you say to me, Richie, I identify as a woman, would you mind referring to me as she and call me Mary? I'd say no problem because you asked me nicely. I think this guy's pissed off because they've attempted to impose this on him. He's in isolation in Mountjoy Jail. Have you been following this? I'm sure you have.
Martin, anyway, what do you make of this?
Well, if you've been following the show, you'll remember that we've had Stella... And of course, this issue of, you know, people being allowed to just change their gender because they say that I'm a woman.
Because they feel like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the issue for me as a man of the left, if you like, is that women's spaces, we you know, there was a whole row about this going back into the 70s and earlier, but should women be allowed to have their own spaces where men are excluded so that they can talk amongst themselves without, you know, men dominating the conversation or whatever. But this is, you know, it's like, if I as a white person identify with black liberation struggles and so on, but does that mean I've got a right to go to an all black meeting and say I identify as black, therefore I can come into this meeting? I'll tell you what I can do is I can put on some blackface so I look like I'm black. This is a problem, and of course, what's really happening underlying all of this, and you'd be surprised that we've probably got quite a lot more in common than you imagine, is I see all of this identity politics as being deliberately weaponized by the powers that be to keep us divided.
Of course, 100%.
And of course, so at the same time, I've got no problem whatsoever with blokes dressing up as women.
No, I mean, why would you?
It's not your business. My other half, when she was a kid in the 1950s, she was on a bus with her parents. And they saw this woman, and then she saw her parents nudging each other and said, that's Kenneth. And that was her uncle, and he was dressed as a woman. And he was eventually arrested and sent to prison.
For public decency.
And he was sent to prison for outraging public decency. And that's how it was. And that's wrong by any definition.
We've won that fight, Martin.
So they're now trying to turn it. It's just great from the powers that be to see good, decent feminists arguing with trans people, and it just makes they just rub their hands to watch us all doing this. And then of course you've got the right wing then get going saying that all of this is a load of nonsense. Perhaps we shouldn't have allowed these people to have sex with the same sex, and so it just gets everybody divided. Meanwhile, as you know, the world is being stolen from us in every possible way.
Okay, divided. But actually, the Queen, coming back to her. She did actually quite a lot to bring people together. I think particularly, horrible to say it, but the Blair government in Northern Ireland did. I lived over there during the Troubles for a year or so in the border country, which was pretty crazy. But one of the most important speeches I think the Queen made, we're going to hear a little clip from it now, is over at Dublin Castle, where actually there's all sort of people shaking hands that had been at each other's throats. So let's have a little listen to that now.
Many British families have members who live in this country, as many Irish families have close relatives in the United Kingdom. These families share the two islands. They have visited each other and have come home to each other over the years. They are the ordinary people who yearned for the peace and understanding we now have between our two nations and between the communities within those two nations. A living testament to how much in common we have. These ties of family, friendship and affection are our most precious resource. They are the lifeblood of the partnership across these islands, a golden thread that runs through all our joint successes so far and all we will go on to achieve. They are a reminder that we have much to do together to build a future for all our grandchildren, the kind of future our grandparents could only dream of. So we celebrate together the widespread spirit of goodwill and deep mutual understanding that has served to make the relationship more harmonious, close, as good neighbours should always be. So, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to rise and join me in a toast to the President and the people of Ireland.
Okay, so that's Queen Elizabeth speaking about a decade ago, Martin. It was quite a momentous event, actually, wasn't it? And it's nice, and I have to confess, having a bit of a tear in my eye listening to that, thinking of her being someone who was able to, despite all the differences and despite the deep state and the horrific machinations that went on in Northern Ireland, to be able to stand there and get people shaking hands together to make peace.
Well, she obviously is. She's reading a script that's been.
She's doing a PR job.
She's reading a script written by the Foreign Office, but she's reading it with conviction. I think also that she was, one of the things that made her particularly popular in Ireland, because she was taken to Croke Park, where there was a massacre in the 1920s. And she, off script, she turned to her Irish hosts who were showing around and she said, "So this is where it happened." So she was, that was off script by her. Mm. And I think that because the loyalist community in Northern Ireland have this monarchist ideology, it was very important, I mean, very important for the more hardline Republicans, for, you know, Martin McGuinness to shake hands with the Queen, as he did. And I don't know about you, Richie, but I'm a big fan of the peace process. I think it was one of the, of all the things that I've been involved in politically over the years, it's the thing that gives me the greatest satisfaction. Because it seemed when I was a teenager that it was absolutely unmanageable and it was never going to be resolved. But it's we did it.
Yeah, I mean, I covered it. I was working for WLRFM in Ireland at the time. I covered it extensively. I was in Belfast quite a bit, travelling up and down. And, yeah, of course, we were delighted. People living in the coastal communities of Waterford, Wexford, Cork, Kerry. Yeah, people were generally delighted. But I look back at it now and I wonder, did it really matter? Because hot on the heels of this reconciliation, or this kind of perceived reconciliation, was the Irish voting against the ratification of the Nice and Lisbon treaties, and then being told by their governments to go back and vote a second time until they got it right. I see Ireland now. I no longer class myself as an Irish Republican. I should say that, and I say that with a heavy heart, as somebody who knows his history, because Ireland is nothing but a fiefdom or an outpost of Brussels. I should say that's my personal opinion. It matters not just Brussels, is it?
It's all the US multinationals that have taken
absolutely
over everything.
Absolutely, Martin. I mean, imagine when our finance minister, I just don't care anymore who it is. I could have told you up until a couple of years ago. I couldn't tell you who the finance minister is now in the coalition government. But when he or she decides to, you know, put forward a fiscal budget for the forthcoming year, it's got to be signed off by usually a man, a very grey-looking man with a briefcase who flies in from Brussels on Ryanair and flies back. I mean, it doesn't matter to me anymore if there's a reunion, if the North, if Ireland becomes united, because Ireland is gone. The Ireland that I romanticised, the Ireland that I fantasised about is long
Richie,
gone.
Richie, I'd love to know, what's happened with the water there? I know that for years it was something which people paid for in rates. It was paid by landlords, and they tried to do a few years ago what they did here in Britain in the Thatcher era, which was to get tenants to pay for water, whereas previously it had been free for the tenants.
That's what they're doing, Tony. Do you know how long that's been going on? That's been going on since the mid-1980s, since I lived in a tiny town called Ballybeg on the outskirts of Waterford. Yeah, and there's been great resistance to that over the years, coming from the trade unions mostly, you know, in the area, and they've been brilliant. There was a very famous incident. I talked about this recently. I don't know if you would have read about this, Martin, but back in 1986 or 1987, the local authorities were sending men around in vans, thugs now, they hired big men, to basically take up manholes and to switch off the water in streets because people wouldn't pay, because people said we're being taxed up to the gills, double taxation, treble taxation. And it was a very famous, very scary incident. One of these vans came into Ballybeg, where I come from. It's a working class, I hate to say that, it's a working community, full of young families, it was at the time, great people, sporty people. These guys were coming in and they were doing it. And eventually they were surrounded one afternoon by about 3,000 people. And they were basically imprisoned in their van for nearly 3 days. One of them took really, really ill as a result of it, which isn't nice. I don't believe in violence, I don't believe in harming people, and I do mean that. But these guys were laughing at people and telling people to F off. And one woman was pushed over by one of these guys. So 3,000, and that's a minimum now, surrounded the van. It was national. I think it even made the news here in the UK. And they said to these guys, you're never coming back in here again. To their credit, they didn't pull them out of the van and beat them up. They just basically locked them in until eventually, I think the church typically got involved and said, right, look, you've made your point now. These are human beings. They've got families waiting for them at home and they're terrorized and they've learned their lesson. And then it went away for a few years. At least it did in the housing estates. Nobody came around. And, you know, it's a great example of non-violent civil disobedience.
Fantastic.
Or protest, you know. But I still think it must have been terrifying for the lads in the van. But they were the ones going around in an area where there was a little bit of economic hardship a little bit. I mean, most people worked, but we didn't, you know, my family didn't earn much. Father worked in a factory at Waterford Crystal, and others worked on the industrial estate nearby. So the people spoke, Tony Martin. They came out and they said, no, we're not having that. And I think you look that up online, you'll find that story.
Yeah, we should. It'd be nice to see the same sort of attitude here, but people I think maybe people's spirit has been broken in a way. They just accept these things now. Anyway, look, from Queen Elizabeth, bless her, to the new
Give
guy.
Over.
The
you
new guy. The new guy, Prince Charles. And I spoke to Robert Hanson yesterday, who we had on earlier, he's over from Hong Kong, about his links to Jimmy Savile.
Prince Charles, if we look, there's plenty of photographs of him throughout the 60s, the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. So there's nothing secretive about this or revealing about it, but there are photographs of him with Jimmy Savile in many different situations, many different occasions for over four decades. We now know from a Channel 4 investigation that the BBC News early as 1971 that Jimmy Savile was essentially committed acts of paedophilia. So to actually have a king who's had relationships with a high-profile person like Savile we don't know for certain, but it's certainly something that should be looked at, may compromise the ability of the king to actually do the best for this country if someone did have a hold on him. And I think that needs to be looked at.
Well, one thing's for sure, Savile made it clear to people that threatened him that he had powerful friends.
He did. I've seen those interviews with Jimmy Savile. Again, he's from Yorkshire, I'm from Yorkshire. I mean, so you do even pay more attention to someone like Savile. I mean, he always gave me the creeps as a kid, and I don't think he ever liked music. But he did say that, powerful friends, and he was also friendly with Edward Heath, who took the UK into the European to European Union. And again, that was a mis-selling. And so was he behind that? I don't know. But he certainly had friends with prime ministers and future kings. So the way the whole system works is if you have – the system likes to get people in power that it can control, and it does this through people like Savile for the British royal family and Epstein to influence America. I mean, Epstein, again, was friendly with Gates. And look what Gates is doing with forced vaccination all around the world. And if you look what Prince Charles is doing, he's promoting the global warming agenda. And there's two ways you're going to control people. One is through vaccination passes, and the other one is through carbon dioxide emissions. And you've got two very influential people, Charles in England, Gates in America, who've had relationships with people known to be paedophiles, and that should be a concern to everybody. And I would have thought it being Prince Charles's best interest and the country's best interest to get that out in the open early on and, you know, discuss that and make a clean break of it. I think that's very important for any king, future king of this country.
Here, here, Robert Hanson. There's a bit of a tendency, I think, with King Charles, sorry, not Prince Charles, King Charles III. There's a bit of a tendency to sort of be in denial about things. He's very much in denial about Diana. No one's allowed to mention Diana. There's no pictures of Diana. Diana's basically been airbrushed out of history, Richie.
Yeah, she has, hasn't she? I wonder how much of that has played a part in the, the evolution of Prince Harry. I don't know. It's fascinating. Regarding Charles, you know, even if you put all your feelings about him and the monarchy and monarchies in general to one side, which I can do, it staggers me that somebody at the Metropolitan Police or somebody higher up wouldn't have interviewed him about... you could have even done it on a friendly basis. You didn't need to interview him under caution, although you could make an argument that he should have been interviewed under caution when this information emerged. The fact that he wasn't even spoken to as a person of interest. Your Highness, we'd like you to come down, or we'd like to come and see you to avoid any embarrassment, but we you might be able to help us with our inquiries around Savile because you and he were so very close. Absolutely, Tony. But that's been airbrushed out of history, Charles's relationship with Savile, not by you and by this programme and by my programme, but by the legacy media. No mention of it ever. Even recently when we saw Savile documentaries. on Disney. Was it the Disney do one, or was it Apple did one? Not a mention, really. Passing mention, maybe. But not that these guys were thick as thieves and they met quite regularly. And nobody can tell me that those charged with the protection of, not just the protection of Charles, but with the protection of the reputation of the royal family, nobody can convince me that they would not have known that Savile was a filthy pederast and much worse. So that's always been my feeling on
no,
it.
No, that's right. And, I mean, we just here in the Bristol area, the Cotswolds area, there was Peter Ball, the Bishop of Gloucester, who was a paedophile and a very close friend of Prince Charles. In fact, Prince Charles even wrote a letter trying to get him off from his... well, it's just for his court case as a character reference, yeah. Basically, before he was convicted. Plus, from the Prince's Trust, we had a BBC presenter here in Bristol who was convicted of paedophilia. I mean, he does seem to have, it's not just the Jimmy Savile, it seems to have be this rather stench of this around Charles. So I wonder, obvious question though, Richie, do you think he'll manage to tough it out as king now?
Why not, unless a decision has been made to expedite William to the throne, his popularity, at least if you believe... Look, the media does a great job of presenting royalty and the royal family as whiter than white. These days, I know you will argue with me quite rightly that maybe back in the 90s the media didn't and was maybe a bit more objective. These days, I think the media acts as the propaganda wing for the royal family. That's just my opinion. Got to say that again. And they love William and his wife, Kate, I think her name is, yeah, and their children, they positively worship them. So maybe Charles's reign has been preordained to be a short one, maybe
almost,
not.
Yeah, almost every, the last two or three months, almost every Mail on Sunday has either the front page or page two scandal to do with Prince Charles.
It goes
on and on and on and on. I mean, he quite clearly has no regard for the law. He thinks he is the law. This is a little bit dangerous, isn't it?
Is there? I'm going to be absolutely slaughtered for saying this by people who know me. Is there mitigation? I know some people. I know you know some people, good people now, people who've worked in the police like Martin, and they've said, Richie, look, we're pretty sure that Charles was abused by his own uncle. We're pretty sure he was. Now, without any,
this is Mountbatten. You're talking about Mountbatten,
yeah. And if that's the case, if Charles was victimized when he was a child, it gives him no excuse whatsoever if he's gone on to aid and abet a paedophile, or worse, by the way, none, before anybody starts to shout at me. But it's like the Michael Jackson thing. Somebody heard me listening to I played a Michael Jackson record once. Oh, he's a dirty rotten paedophile. And I said, well, he might be, or he might have been. We don't know for certain.
I mean, Mountbatten is quite well known to have a penchant for young boys, wasn't he?
Children,
I mean,
he was
the mentor of Prince Charles, Martin.
He was.
Well, I mean, underlying all of this, you mentioned Epstein earlier. Paedophilia is a classic mechanism by which the deep state can blackmail anybody. And of course, what Epstein's doing, they were getting everybody on these flights to the Lolita Island or whatever. And of course, it's all Epstein probably worked for Mossad, and they're just collecting blackmail material on everybody. And I think the intelligence services have been doing this for years. I mean, Richard Hayward, was it Heyman, who was deputy director of MI6? This is before the internet. He left a package of child pornography on the bus, and the people that, you know, it was traced back to him, and it was all hushed up at the time because he was deputy director of MI6. So you've got a culture within. Don't forget, they all went to private schools where the bigger boys do things to little boys, and that's been going on for quite a long time. And it's part of, you know, so it's part of elite culture anyway. But it's also weaponized in a way that allows everybody to be blackmailed. So when it comes to a vote on anything that's controversial, whatever, you know, people can be said, well, you know, you do realize that we've got all these photographs of you, don't you? The Concora Boys Home in Belfast.
Yeah.
It's well known on both sides of the line what was going on there. The MI5 were using the boys in the Concora Boys Home, and they were also then used in other parts of Britain. It wasn't just in Belfast. This is all intelligence service stuff. And so loyalist paramilitaries were tempted in there, photographed having sex with young underage boys, and then of course they got to do what they're told by the intelligence services.
Richie, what do you think happened with Diana? I mean, you know what I think. You've asked me about it many times.
Yeah, when I started doing the more alternative type show back in Spain, back in 2010, which is when we first met Tony, I did interview several times the lovely Noel Botham. Noel, of course, was the war correspondent for The Telegraph for many years, a very serious journalist and a serious writer. And he wrote a book which, God forgive me for not remembering the title, but I think it was The Death of a Princess or The Death of Princess Diana. And he laid out in fine detail a lot of circumstantial evidence, it must be said, but also a lot of good information in there. Noel was convinced that she was murdered by British intelligence agencies working with their counterparts in France. He was convinced of it. Why not? Like, what? Why? I mean, one of the more interesting theories I've heard, and I know I've heard the two of you discuss this, was her campaign against landmines.
Yes, absolutely key, I think. And also, of course, the fact that...
More likely than a hit job by Charles, I suggest.
Well, she was... Look, listen, it's not Charles, is it? It's the establishment, with which Charles, of course, would have had to have, given the nod
probably,
to...
Probably what they would do with Charles is make sure that he isn't in the loop.
No, I don't agree. I think they would have to say, because if he found out about it, he'd be annoyed afterwards. So, John Morgan's book, How They Murdered Princess Diana, has got lots and lots of detail about all of this. He got hold of all of the transcripts of the inquest, etc., etc. And so it just seems that this is the way the British establishment has always operated, whether it's the princes in the tower hundreds of years ago. If someone is in the way, and she was in the way, the way ahead group that was meeting, which was the private secretaries of the royals, to try and manage Diana, they clearly decided that this woman is going to be too much of a problem, and someone at some point, the main trigger for it, I think, wasn't the landmines, it was the fact that she was about to arrive back in London from her holiday with Dodie and announce her engagement to Dodie, and that she was pregnant, at the time that she was pregnant, and this would have been an absolute bombshell underneath, and of course it would be the beginning of a relationship which would be a threat to the royal family probably for a long time. She was talking apparently about possibly going over to Egypt with Dodie and Dodie running for the Egyptian presidency and things like this. So it was the holiday that she had with Dodie and the fact that that she was making arrangements to announce her engagement to him when she came back to London, I think, that was the trigger for it. What do you think, Richie?
Yeah, I can buy all of that, Tony. I just can't believe it's 25 years.
It is a long time, isn't it?
During my holiday, I went to see... I got up on the morning that she was murdered, let's say, because we believe she was murdered. I got up on the morning. I was woken up on the morning by a frantic mother waking me up. And I had to be up early because I was travelling to Dublin to watch U2 at Lansdowne Road with a lot of other lunatics on a big bus that we'd hired. Bonio, and listen, look, I learned later on.
Yeah, right.
I was young. And this was after he was groomed by George Stephanopoulos and Bill Clinton Bono, but we could go into that another day. I know a lot about that. I've written extensively about that. Not that I'm a great writer, but I know a lot about that. But, mum screaming at me. So this Diana, was certainly someone who definitely made an impact on people outside of the UK. Well, that's obvious. I mean, that's a stupid thing for me to say because it's obvious. But even kind of Republican people like my mother and people like that, coming to me and saying, Jesus, Richie, you better get up. why do I need to get up, Well, because Diana has been in a car crash in France and she's dead. Massive. And, of course, Bono took the opportunity several times later that evening. In fact, he sung the lullaby Sleep Tonight. For her. So it was a mega thing at the time. And it was only a few years later, really, that I entertained the idea that foul play...
Yeah, well, she was a genuine person and absolutely a fish out of water in the royal family. But she did deliver the heir and a spare before departing. Anyway, look, Richie, I know you've got to go. It's been absolutely fantastic chatting with you.
Mate.
A really great opportunity on a very important week. And I hope you maybe just give us a little roundup of when people can expect you back on the air again.
Oh, thanks very much. I began a total rebuild of the studio back in very late July. It went belly up a little bit. The worst time in the world for that to happen. August, of course, people not there. We've only just shipped the console back to the continent. There's another console arriving in a week or so's time. Then I'll be back up and running with a brand new studio, which I'm very excited about. And then I'm back on the air Monday to Thursday at 5 o'clock UK time. And the best place people can hear that is the TuneIn app, or just go to my website, richieallen.com. www.ireland.co.uk. But let me just say this, mate. Thanks for having me. I don't get too many invites to do very much. I've loved being on. I love a bit of intellectual, a bit of thought-provoking conversation. And Martin, it was lovely to meet you after hearing you so often. Good to meet you,
pal. And nice to hear from you as well. I'm sure we've got lots in common. And of course, there are real things we're not going to agree about, because there's no point having a political discussion if everybody agrees about everything, is there?
Okay, I know your website is still there. Do you want to just plug that?
Yeah, richieallen.co.uk. And for some reason, you Philistine English types, you always put a T in Richie. There's no T in Richie because there's no T in Richard. So it's richieallen at hotmail.co.uk. Excuse me, Jesus. richieallen.co.uk. What's wrong with me? richieallen.co.uk. That's the one.
Bless you, man. And thanks so much for joining us. The one and only Richie Allen. We're now going to hear a clip from Heath Allen's Unlawful Killing, continuing on the theme of Diana, which is which was the documentary funded by Al Fayed, made by Keith Allen, that looked into the death of Princess Diana, and particularly around the inquest.
Accidental death?
Purely accident.
It was accident.
Was it accidental?
Accidental death.
It was an accident.
Accidental death, I believe.
It was an actual accident.
Accidental death.
Accidental death.
The answers the public gave us were uniformly inaccurate.
They said the paparazzi, didn't they?
The paparazzi chasing her?
I think, yes, it was from the paparazzi.
Around the world, people have been massively misled by the British media into believing that the deaths were an accident caused by the paparazzi. But in reality, the jury did not blame the paparazzi, and they decided that the crash was not a mere accident, but something much more serious. In the end, the jury delivered the most powerful verdict that the coroner had left open to them. Unlawful killing is defined in law as homicide or manslaughter, and the jury blamed the following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
What is also interesting, overlooked, I think, almost totally by the media and commentators, was the wording of the verdict. Well, the detail of this verdict was such that it was an unlawful killing contributed to by, and one of the factors was, following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
Initially, journalists were confused, but within minutes, the BBC was reporting that the jury had blamed the paparazzi, and the rest of the media followed the example of the British establishment's impartial broadcaster. Soon, the verdict had been spun by the media into an accident caused by the paparazzi.
Against the paparazzi.
And so,
a lie
got halfway around the world, while the truth was still putting its boots on.
Paparazzi.
The altered verdict was still on the BBC's news website at the time of making this documentary.
People will still go on thinking there is something happening here, because they know the British establishment, they know their capacity for cover-ups. The newspapers in this country really don't want to upset the very top.
The most bizarre thing is that normal people in this country who don't necessarily enjoy conspiracy theories, if you go to a bar, you'll find three people who go, ooh, but the royals did it, didn't they?
I think most of the British public still believe it was dodgy. I believe Mohammed Al Fayed will always believe it's dodgy. I believe the establishment want it all to just go away for whatever reason, and I don't know the answers to these questions. All I know is that the inquest has probably raised more questions than in the end it answered, and it answered a lot of questions.
I would still say it was fantastically convenient for the monarchy that this woman died. Just think what she might be saying now if she hadn't died. Think what a problem it would have created for Camilla. Think of, it would have created serious constitutional problems. That even she was perfectly capable of being somebody who started a movement to end the monarchy.
Diana has been airbrushed out of official royal history. No action has been taken against the police chiefs who suppressed Diana's sworn statement predicting that the royal family would kill her in a car crash. Instead, they both now sit in the House of Lords. Mohammed Al Fayed was ordered by Prince Philip to take down the royal warrants that had hung for decades outside Harrods. And shortly before selling the store in 2010, and more in sorrow than in anger, he symbolically burned them in sight of his son's grave.
I am destroying this royal crest as a tribute to my son, Dodi. I feel that he is looking down on this today. There was a clear verdict of unlawful killing. So why has nobody been arrested? What is at the core of all this is racism. Powerful people in this country, my country, don't want to hear me talking about Prince Philip's Nazi background, but I have to, because it's just 100% true. They wouldn't accept me or my son. And when he fell in love with Diana, they murdered them.